care options, find providers willing to absorb the bill or pay out of the pocket. In the administration's letter to Congress, officials said it will be too late if Congress waits until there is another surge to provide funding. The letter also addresses several consequences arising from the lack of sustained funding, some of which include not having enough booster shots, a lack of funding to research additional vaccines that could provide protection against future variants, scaling back preventive treatments for the immunocompromised individuals and being blindsided by future variants. Not only will the lack of funding affect currently infected individuals in the U.S., but it also increases the possibility of a spread, putting more of the population at risk, said Dr. George C. Benjamin, the executive director of the American Public Health Association, adding, "This can raise the chance of more threatening variants becoming widespread." Despite repeated requests, additional COVID-19 resources haven't been approved. Instead, Republican senators are asking the administration for a detailed account of how the previous round of funding was spent. Without government funding, the cost for a COVID-19 test can run from between $20 to $850, with $127 being the median cost. There has recently been a reduced demand from citizens who can no longer afford to pay for COVID-19 tests and other healthcare resources out of pocket, which has made it increasingly difficult for some testing sites to operate. As a result, many states and healthcare organizations have resorted to shutting down. New Hampshire closed all state-managed COVID-19 vaccination sites at the end of March, stating vaccination numbers were high enough. In San Diego, officials closed the Jacobs Center vaccination site because of a decline in requests for testing and vaccination, and instead opened up mobile clinics. For now, they are still offering tests free of charge despite federal funding running out. Embry Health, a leading COVID-19 testing provider in Arizona, recently announced it would suspend testing at 60 sites and ask individuals without insurance to pay $100 for COVID-19 tests and $200 for rapid PCR test at the remaining locations. Embry was paying for the uninsured to get tests after the government funding stopped on March 22, 2022, but as of April 2nd can no longer afford to do so, the company said in a statement. CDR Health, a Florida-based company that offered COVID-19 tests to nearly 15,000 people a day during surges, has also closed down all 30 of its free testing centers due to lack of funding. Survey data estimates there were 28 to 31 million uninsured people in the U.S. in 2020, and as many as 14.4 million people will be at risk of losing their health insurance coverage when the public health emergency ends. So while paid testing will continue to be available, it won't be affordable or accessible for everyone, especially for marginalized communities who already face systematic healthcare bias. In the U.S., communities of color and low-income families accounted for a disproportionate number of COVID-19 cases and deaths, and experts say the lack of funding will further widen these health and economic inequities. Low-income communities and uninsured individuals, which often includes communities of color, are at the greatest risk because they will not have the financial means or insurance protections to cover vaccinations, testing, and healthcare if the federal government runs out of money to pay for them, Benjamin said. A majority of the U.S. population has received their COVID-19 vaccination doses by now. Data from Bloomberg's COVID-19 vaccination tracker shows 567 million doses have been administered as of April 13th. This may partially explain why fewer people are visiting vaccination centers, but experts warn this does not mean the pandemic is over or that there is no more need for doses or testing. Benjamin said if the BA.2 variant causes big outbreaks or there is a new variant spreading, we will not be prepared for another surge of infections without federal funding. Without the required funding, the U.S. government is unable to purchase further life-saving monoclonal antibody medicines or provide boosters, shots, and other variant-specific immunizations, said Lyle Solomon, a principal attorney at Oakview Law Group. Solomon added, there will be a gradual reduction in the money available to pay doctors and other healthcare providers who treat those uninsured. In situations like these, healthcare providers will need to absorb the cost of uninsured patients or turn them away, which will widen the gap in access to necessary care. Not having access to free tests and vaccinations will only reduce the number of people getting the shot, which will become a major problem if cases increase again or if a new variant arises. Benjamin said, we are still not at the optimal level of vaccination, including booster shots.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organization, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of the Subcontinent, we will discuss the expansion of the China-Pakistan economic corridor to Afghanistan. And protests and nationwide strikes against economic policies.
The China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, or the CPEC, is a reinforced bilateral partnership project. The aim of this corridor is to enhance connectivity of the two countries, accelerate economic progress, and ensure sustainable development. The CPEC was formally launched in 2015 at an estimated cost of $46 billion. It includes highways, railways, fiber optic networks, energy networks, ports, and economic zones. The multi-billion-dollar project can connect the two countries through the disputed region of Kashmir and the strategically located areas of Afghanistan.
The China-Pakistan Economic Corridor is a flagship project of Chinese President Xi Jinping and part of the Belt and Road Initiative. The CPEC, CPEC, paves the way for further trade ties between China and Pakistan by modernizing pertinent air, energy, and transportation systems, as well as establishing special economic zones.
Now the main focus on the Belt and Road will be on the development of the local population. And Karot is one of the CPEC project. It is the first hydel power project under CPEC. The greatest benefit to the people of Pakistan will be that we will get a green and clean energy and at a very competitive rate.
The ultimate goal of the project is to connect the deep-sea Pakistani ports of Gwadar and Karachi to China's Xinjiang province. But the corridor, if it connects the two countries directly, needs to run along Kashmir, a bloodily disputed region between Pakistan and India. The other possibility for the corridor is to run through Afghanistan, where poor to non-existent security has been the main impediment. However, the Taliban has paved the way for the project by managing to lower violent incidents in the country. 3 years before the Taliban takeover, Beijing discussed the project with Kabul, but the Afghan government never took any steps to address the security issues. According to an informed source, the role of Afghanistan in the CPEC was discussed by the Taliban Foreign Minister Amir Khan Muttaqi and the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi in his visit to Kabul in late March. The Pakistani side held discussions with Kabul regarding the extension of the project to Afghanistan mere weeks after the retaking of power by the Taliban last year.
Afghanistan was traditionally a transport hub of the ancient Silk Road, but after a long time it lost the position due to many conflicts such as civil wars, war with the Soviet Union and the US invasion that lasted until August of 2021. Many of the country's international trade prospects and opportunities were locked by the wars, either improperly utilized by the incompetent Afghan lackeys or the uncaring foreign investors. And now, the expansion of the CPEC to Afghanistan can be seen as a blessing for the war-torn country.
The CPEC, CPEC, has brought a new dream for the people of Afghanistan, which guarantees their country's development in the long term. Afghanistan's joining the CPEC is now supported by most of its neighbors. China was very quick to reopen its embassy in Kabul after the Taliban takeover last August. It is now building a road to the Afghan border through its Xinjiang province. Maybe this is why the Taliban announced that it considers China a major partner in its effort to rebuild the war-torn country. Meanwhile, Russia has shown an interest in working with Afghanistan. Pakistan says under the CPEC it will provide Afghanistan with transport facilities using its Gwadar port. Pakistan also wants Afghanistan to play an active role in China's Belt and Road Initiative. At the same time, fearing Washington's possible threats has affected Islamabad, especially now that there are talks of US involvement in Prime Minister Imran Khan's removal from power. Imran Khan's case was a clear example that Pakistani politicians, whose foreign policy is not parallel to US diktats, are sooner or later challenged by Washington. It remains to be seen whether Kabul and Islamabad will withstand all this US pressure, or if they will instead withdraw from a massive joint economic project with Washington's trade opponent.
Now, to have more insight on the expansion of the CPEC to Afghanistan, we are joined by Mr. Jabin Jacob, Associate Professor at Shiv Nada University in New Delhi. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Jacob. Now, let's begin with the CPEC's expansion to Afghanistan, which is clearly beneficial for the trio. So the question is, how could the region in general benefit from this, especially in terms of security? And do you think Afghanistan under the Taliban is more secure than the previous government of Ashraf Ghani?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say that the CPEC's expansion to Afghanistan is clearly beneficial to all three countries. One of the reasons why it wasn't the case was because the Chinese government did not fully support the ruling government in Afghanistan at that point in time. So from the present perspective, yes, I think under the Taliban, Afghanistan is certainly more secure than the previous government because there aren't any countries or any non-state actors trying to undermine this particular government. And there is support from the neighbors, Afghanistan's immediate neighbors, both China and Pakistan, for the ruling regime of the Taliban in Afghanistan. So yes, from that perspective, this is the kind of support that the Ashraf Ghani government or the previous governments did not have.
Now, Mr. Jacob, why do you think the previous US-backed government of Afghanistan did not utilize the resources to join the CPEC?
So, I think the situation is a little more complicated. Certainly, an element of the US-China rivalry had a role to play. But if you look at the record of the CPEC within Pakistan itself, you will find there's a lot of debate over the last few years about what the Pakistanis are getting out of the CPEC. Plus, you look at China's own record inside Afghanistan. China was part of several major projects, iron ore extraction and so on. Inside Afghanistan, they were made, the Chinese had made big commitments, but none of them actually came to fruition. I mean, none of them were actually followed through. So I suppose there was also concern about the gap between the rhetoric and the implementation as far as the Chinese were concerned. And if the Chinese can't do this properly inside Afghanistan itself, then I think there are legitimate doubts about how much Afghanistan could have benefited by joining CPEC.
Mr. Jacob, what does the expansion of the CPEC to Afghanistan mean to India?
If Afghanistan is able to gain economically, I think if Afghanistan can get out of its current morass of lack of availability of food grains, lack of economic activity, then certainly if the CPEC actually helps towards improving the situation, why not? I mean, India also wants a stable, prosperous Afghanistan. But again, I think we must come back to the record of the CPEC itself in Pakistan, the debt burden that the Pakistanis have taken on, the gap between rhetoric and implementation, the fact that old technologies are being used for power generation, the fact that there are environmental consequences to the CPEC, the impact on the Pakistani economy itself from the CPEC. I mean, we find Pakistani businessmen, entrepreneurs having a range of complaints about the CPEC. Now, some of these could be feeding problems. Some of these could be in the beginning, you know, there could be some issues. But I think overall on the record, if you look at the press, the analysts of the CPEC from within Pakistan itself, you'll find there are a lot of concerns and complaints. There's an issue of lack of transparency and so on. So now if that model is going to be transposed to also to Afghanistan, then I think we end up making a bad situation worse in Afghanistan. That is India's concern.
Mr. Jacob, how do you think trans-regional powers, especially the U.S., would react to the expansion of the CPEC to Afghanistan? And do you think if Kabul and Islamabad would be able to withstand Washington's possible pressure?
At the moment, my sense is that the Americans are done with Afghanistan. I think like many other countries, what they would like to see is some degree of economic stability, economic growth, ensure that the people are taken care of, people feel secure. But I don't think that the Americans are in any position right now to intervene any longer in the Afghan theater. And how the relationship between Kabul and Islamabad develops is really up to Islamabad and Kabul. I don't think the Americans are going to put a great deal of pressure on this. I mean, they do not have the bandwidth at the moment, given what is happening in Russia, Ukraine, given what is happening with China. So pretty much, I think the Pakistanis and the Afghans are on their own. Washington certainly is not going to be such an important factor right now.
On that note, I would like to thank Professor Jacob for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted to the expansion of the CPEC to Afghanistan.
Sajid Khan is a user based in Islamabad. He believes this will be a game changer, bringing peace and prosperity to the whole region. Azhar Salim is another Pakistani user who believes the CPEC will result in permanent peace between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Ahmad Saeed Hijazi says such international commitments will help all countries in the region.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The Indian capital, New Delhi, has recently been the stage for many protester groups. One day, uncategorized workers take to the streets. Another day, people who protest fuel prices. And then, farmers whose products are not procured by the state. What's surprising is that the protests and strikes are taking place not only in the capital, but also nationwide, only a few weeks after the general election, in which the BJP celebrated its victory in 4 out of 5 states.
Hundreds of people, mainly unskilled workers, gathered at New Delhi's Jantar Mantar area close to Parliament on March the 29th to protest the economic policies under Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government. They held the red flag of the labour unions and chanted anti-government slogans. The demonstrators included farmers, roadway and transportation workers, health sector contractors, employees of banks and insurance companies. The protest was part of a 2-day strike that began a day earlier throughout the country. The strike was called by 12 labour unions. They demanded that the government provide social security coverage for all, increase the minimum wage, run employment guarantee programs, and annul a new law that removes employers' limitations on setting a minimum wage for maximum working hours. According to official media reports, some 50 million people joined the strike, which was the first major nationwide protest since the ruling party, the Bharatiya Janata Party, won 4 of 5 state elections last month. The strike was followed by several other protests, such as a protest against the fuel price hike led by Congress leader Rahul Gandhi, bank officials, and most recently, the protest over the government's new paddy procurement policy, which is impacting over 6 million farmers and their families.
Farmers, financial sector staff, including banking and insurance, transport and electricity workers, all participated in the nationwide protests. They believe the policies of this administration are anti-worker, anti-farmer, anti-people and anti-national. People from literally all walks of life participated in the strikes and protested against India's economic policies under the Modi government. The two main issues are that people do not have money and they do not have a way to make money. Now, let's see how the state's policies have affected the economy and employment.
Similar to many other countries, India suffered economically from COVID-19, but it managed to partially recover from it. Still, for Indian workers, the situation is not stable, as many jobs have vanished. The unemployment rate of 8% last December indicates that tens of millions of people were looking for jobs. Unemployment traces its roots back to 2010, when the Indian economy started to decline, which slowed down the pace of job creation. When Modi took office in 2014, he promised to create 100 million jobs in 8 years. However, his government's policies have created controversies in terms of the economy and poor employment. As part of the anti-corruption policy, the government started demonetization in 2016, a major shock to the economy. A study by Azim Premji University revealed some 5 million people lost their jobs due to this policy alone. Another major controversy is the privatization of several state-owned banks. The government says selling public assets will bring about an economic overhaul. This will enable private banks to take over the market, which was once dominated by public banks. Clearly, the policy of maximizing profit for the private banks is neither good for the public nor beneficial for the bank's own employees, who see their benefits disappearing.
Now, to have more insight on the economic issues in India, we are joined by Mr. Saeed Khan, Director of Global Studies at Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan. Now, welcome to the program, Mr. Khan. As we know, the 2-day strike was the first nationwide protest after the BJP victory in 4 out of 5 states in the recent general election. So, if Indians are unhappy with the economic policies, why did they vote for the ruling party?
Well, I think that there's a few reasons of what's going on there. First of all, unemployment is a chronic issue in India. It's seen as basically systemic, and it runs across all religious lines or communities. But what you're having here is a situation that, along with this kind of expectation of unemployment, you also have a public which certainly was emboldened by the recent success of the farmers' strike, which happened last year, particularly among farmers from the Punjab. They thought that they were going to be able to extract similar concessions and pledges from the Modi government, but the Modi government doesn't seem to be necessarily either interested or, quite frankly, capable of bringing unemployment under control there. The other issue, of course, is the fact that the government has been very effective in stanching a lot of the opposition and a lot of the protests. For example, the governments of Kerala and West Bengal put a ban on the ability for government employees to participate in the protests. Labor unions and trade unions were hoping to have 200 million people out in the streets for these kinds of protests and strikes. It seems that only one-fourth of that, about 50 million, showed up. Maharashtra, for example, another BJP stronghold, invoked an emergency law banning 80,000 workers from being able to protest. So there's definitely a coordinated effort by the government to try to quell the ability for people to then be able to voice their protests against the government. In many ways, we could argue that they learned from last year with the farmers' strike. But I think it's also very important to recognize that in India, and it is a very vast country, the media has essentially become the water carriers, so to speak, for the government. One can watch the media in India and really not find any meaningful criticism, critique, or debate about these kinds of issues. There is a wholesale blame that is put on others, including everyone from the foreign workers, the foreign investors, foreign governments, as well as COVID. And sometimes even the internal religious minority communities for causing the kind of misery that is there. So when we have then an echo chamber, if you will, for the public, it's not boding well when it comes to recognizing the kind of damage that the economic policies of the Modi government are doing.
So, Mr. Khan, how do you think Indians' lives will be affected by the privatization of public banks?
Well, we see already that the privatization of other sectors has been very damaging. The Modi government had, for example, demonetized the currency, taking out of circulation certain denominations of the rupee. Well, this was something that was going to affect the average Indian far more adversely than it was going to impact the wealthy. The wealthy, of course, tend to do their financial transactions with wire transfers or oftentimes in foreign currencies. So this was going to hurt small business owners primarily, and it was also going to, unfortunately and disproportionately, impact those who were in the least viable position to go ahead and deal with this. This was one of the reasons, again, why we saw the wide-scale protests against the privatization of the agriculture sector. Indians are quite well aware, then, that this move toward privatization only benefits the wealthy, and that in many ways it's taking public funds away. So essentially, it's a shift in funds from the individual to a select few industrialists and capitalists. It's not going to go over very well, but again, the government has been very effective in creating distractions and diversions for the public so that they don't then feel as though they can necessarily blame the government for it. And I think we can expect a lot of that to happen moving forward as these privatization effects and efforts continue.
Mr. Khan, how do you think the marginalization of the minority, especially the 200 million Muslim community, have worsened the unemployment?
Well, we see that unemployment generally runs higher in the religious minority communities. For example, in rural areas, the Hindu unemployment rate might be 5.7, whereas for Muslims it might be 6.7. For Sikhs, it would be 6.2%. In the case of urban areas, the Hindu unemployment rate is 6.9%, but for Muslims it's 7.5%, and again for Sikhs it's 7.2%. Now, of course, that means it's a higher percentage for a smaller community when it comes to Muslims and Sikhs. So the impact on that community is going to be felt far higher. It's not difficult to then suspect that the kind of demonization of religious minorities is translating into unemployment, because it means fewer opportunities. And it also means, after all, that when we see some of the violence that is conducted against religious minority-owned businesses, that is then going to have a ripple effect, and it's going to have a multiplier effect. Many of these religiously owned businesses among the minority communities are family businesses, or they employ people from within their own respective religious community. So the destruction of, say, a small business might affect and impact the employment potential for several families, let alone individuals.
Thank you, Mr. Khan, for being on the program. Love to have you with us again. Now, let's head to social media and see what people think about India's economy under the Modi government.
Ravi Kiran is an Indian user who says the government has reduced corporate tax and increased the fuel tax, which further pressures the public. Narsingh Shukla slams Modi government for the declining economy, rising of unemployment and inflation. Raj Tiwari has shared a cartoon criticizing small wages of Indian youth.
And that was our episode covering the CPEC expansion to Afghanistan and the nationwide protests by laborers in India. We shall meet again next week, so till then, take good care.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In South Africa, a network of researchers are studying whether new lineages BA4 and BA5 escape immunity from COVID-19 vaccines and prior infections. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Amy Maxman, writer. This article is published under the heading, Are New Omicron Subvariants a Threat? Here's how scientists are keeping watch. Here's more. The viruses have the attention of the World Health Organization, WHO, because, according to lab studies, their mutations might enable them to evade immunity gained from COVID-19 vaccines or prior infections more strongly than existing versions of Omicron. De Oliveira is clear, however, that he isn't panicked by BA4 and BA5, although the subvariants have rapidly gained ground in South Africa during the past month. Rates of COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations are stable in the country. He is also unruffled because he's been through this before. His team has made similar discoveries during the pandemic and knows the drill. Right now, he says, it's just time to work carefully and diligently, but calmly. Scientists are now studying the subvariants so far detected in 9 countries to determine whether their effect is serious enough to warrant interventions. SARS-CoV-2 will continue to mutate as it evolves, but not every variant will be newsworthy. to determine what merits attention, Wendy Barclay, a virologist at Imperial College London, says that researchers focus on two factors. We care about a difference in disease severity, and we care about a variant that evades vaccines. Because even if we have the same severity, an increase in cases still has a big impact on life. At the same time, researchers are grappling with how to communicate their concerns and the uncertainty about variants openly while not provoking unnecessary government policies and anxiety. Late last year, when De Oliveira's team detected the original Omicron, countries including the US and the UK invoked travel bans against South Africa. The bans failed to prevent the variant spread, but severely damaged the already struggling South African economy. If that happens again, De Oliveira says, I would stop sharing data in real time with the world, but would continue sharing with my government to guide our own response. On April 1st, Edwin Wilkinson, a bioinformation on De Oliveira's team at Stellbach, saw that researchers at the center's lab and at the National Institute for Communicable Diseases in Johannesburg had flagged several abnormal SARS-CoV-2 genome sequences in their latest batch of data. The sequences had a few notable mutations in the region of SARS-CoV-2 that encodes its spike protein. Because the spike protein is key to the virus invading cells, Wilkinson recognized an urgent need to hunt for these mutations in all of the genomes sequenced in the country over the past few months to see if they had skirted by unnoticed. Working through the weekend, he and his colleagues found that they had. A month earlier, during the first week of March, the BA4 and BA5 sequences comprised around 5% of the roughly 500 genomes sequenced in South Africa. By the first week of April, the portion had risen by 50%. That week, an international virus classification group determined that BA4 and BA5 were indeed their own separate lineages on the Omicron family tree and gave them their names. In addition to the accumulating sequences from South Africa, a relatively small number of BA4 sequences have been uploaded to the data platform GISAID from Botswana, Belgium, Denmark, and the UK in the past 2 weeks, and BA5 has shown up from China, France, Germany, and Portugal. One thing that makes BA4 and BA5 stand out to virologists is an amino acid mutation they share called F486V. It is located on the virus's spike protein near where the protein attaches to the ACE2 receptor on cells, an interaction that opens the door to infection. Important antibodies generated in response to COVID-19 vaccines and to prior infections with SARS-CoV-2 neutralize the virus by clinging to this spot. Since last year, virologists began noticing the vulnerability of this spot in lab experiments. For example, virologist Benora Lee at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City and his colleagues were helping to vet a promising monoclonal antibody treatment by exposing it to an artificial virus carrying many versions of the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein. Only one version of the spike protein evaded their antibodies. It had a mutation nearly identical to F486V. At the time, Lee was relieved that the mutation was vanishingly rare in real life, struggling that it hindered the virus in some way. Only about 50 of the nearly 10 million SARS-CoV-2 sequences in GISAID contained the mutation. So Lee felt assured that the antibody treatment would still be broadly useful. But with the rapid rise of BA4 and BA5 in South Africa, it seems that the coronavirus has evolved so that the mutation no longer holds it back, Lee explains. Lorenzo Sabisi, a virologist at the WHO, says the agency is tracking the two sublineages. But before it draws any conclusion about whether they pose an additional threat compared with other Omicron variants, it needs to learn more from epidemiological studies of people. Immunologists are also approaching the question of immune escape by exposing samples of BA4 and BA5 to blood drawn from people previously infected with SARS-CoV-2 and people who have been vaccinated. This is why we straight away gave samples to researchers around the world, the Oliveira team says. That included researchers in South Africa and the UK, as well as those at US National Institutes of Health and Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Right after identifying BA4 and BA5, the Oliveira also met with South African government and a consortium of about 200 researchers in the country to strategize next steps. With no increase in hospitalizations in South Africa and only about 1,200 cases per day, he advised the government against setting stricter guidances that the country already has. So far, the government hasn't changed its rules. De Oliveira was particularly careful with how he conveyed news of variants to health officials from other countries, asking them to keep watch while not triggering largely futile policies such as travel bans that can cause more harm than good. "We have a lot of pressure on us," De Oliveira says. "When we reported Omicron, me and my colleagues got death threats. We had to put security in front of the lab." In the face of such tensions, Barclay applauds South Africa's surveillance work and transparency. Although this year's SARS-CoV-2 variants cause, on average, less severe diseases than earlier versions of the virus, she says that's not a sign that the coronavirus will continue to become weaker. In addition to acquiring usual mutations, SARS-CoV-2 can evolve rapidly through recombination, inserting one chunk of a sequence from a variant into the genome of another. If an Omicron variant recombines with a different SARS-CoV-2 variant, it might produce a virus that both evades immunity and makes people sicker, Barclay says. "It would be great if these new variants are part of a trend in which the virus is becoming milder, but there is no biological reason to believe that will always be the case."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Thank you.
Israeli forces have stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds and attacked the Palestinian worshippers there. The raid began at dawn on Friday when Israeli forces entered the compound through the Moroccan Gate, also known as the Mughrabi Gate, throwing stun grenades and shooting rubber bullets at the crowd indiscriminately. 400 Palestinians were arrested. Media reports said the Israeli forces also attacked paramedics and press crews, chased them in the courtyards of Al-Aqsa Mosque, and beat a number of them. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society reported that 152 fasting Palestinians had been transferred to hospitals in the occupied Al-Quds for injuries as a result of the raid. Following the Friday prayers, people held rallies in the Gaza Strip in solidarity with the Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
They want it for themselves. They want the Palestinians gone. They want Islam to be gone from Palestine and Christianity too, everything except Judaism. So really, they don't mind having this as a flashpoint for them, as a center of dispute. They want this dispute to go on until they win. That's what they're looking for. And every time they bring settlers there to cause trouble, it's part of what they see as a continuing war for their control of the land. That's what this is about.
The regime has stepped up its deadly acts of aggression across the Palestinian territories since the beginning of Ramadan, as a result of which Palestinians put up a stronger resistance to counter the aggression. The events unfolding in the occupied territories are reminiscent of clashes between the Israeli forces and Palestinians in the West Bank last year that led to an 11-day war between the resistance groups in Gaza and Israel. Over 250 Palestinians were killed in the war, many of them were women and children. Observers now believe that more confrontations are imminent. As the pressure mounts, Palestinians have stepped up their retaliatory operations against Israelis. Over the past 3 weeks, Palestinians have carried out 4 such retaliatory operations, killing over a dozen Israelis. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has given the regime's forces a free hand to crack down on Palestinians. He has also called on Israeli civilians with gun licenses to carry weapons in public.
They can find ways to make the Israeli occupation painful, and already actually quite a few Israelis over the last decade have emigrated elsewhere. You have Israeli immigration into Europe and the United States and to Australia. Possibly as many as 1 million Israelis have done that. If the Palestinians can make it painful enough for the Israelis might just disappear.
When some Arab states announced the normalization of ties with Israel, they claimed that their moves will help the Palestinian cause. But the events of the past couple of years have shown that the only contribution their newly established ties with Tel Aviv made to Palestinians has been even more suffering. In the absence of any accountability, Israel is expected to put even more pressure on the people of Palestine. But the Palestinians are indicating that they remain steadfast to keep fighting against the Israeli occupation with or without international support.
Racial tensions are running high in Grand Rapids, Michigan, after police this week released footage of a white officer lying on the back of an unarmed black man, shooting him in the head. Patrick Leoya, 26, was killed on April 4th after a struggle during a traffic stop. State police are investigating the incident. The officer is currently on administrative leave pending the outcome of the investigation. Authorities say he would not be identified unless criminal charges are pressed against him. The family of Loyoya called the video of the shooting, quote, the most horrifying thing they've ever seen, and asked for the officer's name to be released. The shooting has led to protests in the area, with activists expressing grief and frustration with years of inaction on policing issues by Grand Rapids leaders.
Given the U.S.'s long history of police brutality, from Rodney King to George Floyd and now today, we can't be shocked. And I think that the Black community should and is justified in being angry at the establishment and seeking methods outside of the establishment and the political structure for seeking change.
The fatal shooting of the unarmed Black man by the white officer is the latest on a very long list of similar incidents. Police killings of Black men have dominated national debates in recent years, particularly after the 2020 murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, which triggered persistent protests across America. The deep-rooted problem lingers on. So far this year, over 250 people have been fatally shot by on-duty police officers nationwide. The latest case is another bitter reminder that the system in the United States has failed to take measures to resolve the pressing problem. The April 4th shooting has once again brought deadly police violence in America under the spotlight. Civil rights organization, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, has been quick to react. The NAACP, which tries to advance justice for African Americans, said in a statement that the shooting is horrifying and deeply frustrating because Americans had meaningful legislation designed to avoid exactly what they are witnessing in this week's police video. It said the involved officer has blood on his hands, and so do the senators who killed the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. The piece of legislation was passed by the U.S. House of Representatives in March 2021, but bipartisan negotiations in the U.S. Congress over the police reform bill ended in stalemate. The sweeping legislation was passed by the House amid outcry after the murder of George Floyd. It would have banned chokeholds and qualified immunity for law enforcement. It would have also created national standards for policing in an effort to increase accountability.
Lack of efforts to reform the system that are coming from the top. There's no real incentive for legislators to reform when they are benefiting off of the corrupt policing system and corrupt judicial system that this country has. There's also a lack of struggle in the organizations, a lack of structure in the organizations that are struggling against police brutality.
The failure to pass the police reform has been considered as a setback for the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden, who had energetically supported the legislation. President Biden has faced growing calls to sign an executive order to reform the police, but has failed to act. Experts believe ethnic minorities in America, especially African Americans, are facing a very deep-rooted problem that will not be resolved anytime soon. Observers have largely attributed this to the racist roots of American policing and social structures.
Nearly 7 weeks have passed since the start of the war in Ukraine. Russia is now focusing on taking territory in the eastern regions of the country. Ukraine and Russia are building up their military forces in the eastern regions of Donetsk and Luhansk.
It's a very serious situation. The fact that the Russian forces are there have made significant moves, especially in the east of Ukraine and other parts, is unacceptable to the United States, and they're not prepared to negotiate. And I believe that their advice to Zelensky, docked into Biden today to assured him of about, what was $130 million more worth of equipment, that they want them to continue fighting, to continue resisting, but they're not going to send any troops there.
Over the past weeks, Ukraine has enjoyed the support of Western powers, especially the United States. Western nations have sent different types of weapons to Ukraine worth millions of dollars. The U.S. is to announce $750 million in new military aid for Ukraine. The new military aid package would likely include military equipment such as unmanned surface vehicles, Mi-17 helicopters, howitzers and protective equipment against possible chemical attacks, the Pentagon has hosted leaders from the top 8 U.S. weapons manufacturers to discuss the industry's capacity to help arm Ukraine, even if Russia's invasion lasts as long as 2 years.
So there will be a lot more people dying because the United States is insistent, I think, that Putin's forces have to be forced out of Ukraine before this is all over. And it's not going to be happening anytime soon.
Resupplying as well as planning for a longer war were expected to be discussed at the meeting. The Pentagon has said smaller systems such as Javelin anti-tank missiles and Stinger anti-aircraft missiles have proved to be the most useful weapons. Washington and its Western allies have been shipping these weapons to Ukraine on a nearly daily basis. A partnership between Lockheed Martin and Raytheon Technologies makes the anti-tank Javelin. Raytheon manufactures the Stinger, which shoots down aircraft. Ukraine is ramping up its campaign for military aid even as the U.S. accelerates shipments of weapons to Kiev. Arms lobbyists and their underlings in Congress and the Pentagon are scrambling now to unlock more funds for the military-industrial complex to pump out weapons to Europe.
Unless there are other parties within the world community and also even within NATO to resist this type of policy, it's going to be a very long and costly war. And the cost is going to be borne by the world community, which will suffer in increasing food prices, increasing energy, increasing starvation for millions of people.
But amid the unanimous support for Ukraine, there are critical voices that have been raised against supplying weapons to Ukraine. It's argued that the money channeled to the military industry is used to fuel more bloodshed in Ukraine. Hawks in the West lobby recklessly for NATO to impose a no-fly zone over Ukraine.
They believe that a world empire effectively can be created, in which the United States is the fundamental maker of the rules. Now, every attempt to create an empire in the world has ended up in either failure or disaster. They haven't learned those lessons.
That could be a direct military confrontation between Russia and Ukraine. It's also feared that a nuclear war is also becoming a possibility. A recent poll has shown that the U.S. is being drawn into an all-out war with Russia.
A new report released by Iran's Nur News website on Monday says undercover Israeli military personnel deployed to U.S. bases in the region are conducted their own missions independent of American forces present in those bases. The report says the important point about regional presence is the deployment of undercover military and intelligence agents of Israel in some regional countries that enjoy close relations with Iran. Experts believe that the main goal behind the presence of the Israeli agents in some regional countries is to spy on and collect direct information related to Iran's important bases and sensitive facilities.
It's a very dangerous precedent. What we now know is that the IDF and the Zionist regime's different intelligence units like Mossad are working within Central Command, are working alongside U.S. Forces, NATO forces, and their allies, the Gulf states in the region. And they are their main focus is to control what's going on in the region and ultimately to fight against Iran. And this is a dangerous escalation. And we've seen it now over the past few years, first with the United States removal from the JCPOA, the brutal assassination of General Soleimani, and the increasing hawkish nature of U.S. foreign policy.
The report notes that although the Iranian armed forces are closely monitoring these provocative moves, for which the host countries are also responsible, the nature of these actions will increase tension and instability in the region and can lead to unpredictable conditions. It added that high-resolution documented photos are available on the presence of Israeli regime's aircraft and espionage equipment in the U.S.